space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
All right, everybody, here we are. The final TOS movie, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which is the final appearance of the original series cast all in one place at one time. We're joined by Clay. Clay, how are you?
I'm good. I was really excited to watch Star Trek VI starring Christian Slater.
Yeah, who'd have thought, right? An uncredited appearance by Christian Slater, too.
Yeah, and also Kim Cattrall, which I don't think she was very good.
I can only, having been married for whatever it's been now, 4 years or whatever, and
to Kim Cattrall.
Yes, yeah, to Kim Cattrall, and together long before that. I think the only thing I can associate her was with Sex and the City at this point. And
oh yeah,
I spend the entire time just thinking, what would Samantha do in this situation? And apparently,
probably something dirty. She's such a scamp.
She is. Second, quick 10-second thing. Do you know anything about Sex and the City? And if so, what do you think about Sex and the City?
I know nothing about Sex and the City.
Have you ever seen it?
I have not. I think there's a guy with a big dick in it.
There is. Yeah, there's a couple episodes.
And the ladies talk about, you know, what it's like to have sex in the city.
Yeah. Sex and the City. I don't know if it's great, good, or bad. It's that's my take on Sex and the City. Some of it's
is
okay.
Is that really, like, regressive and sexist of me for the one thing I know about Sex and the City? Be like, oh, here's a guy, big dick in that show.
Well, yeah, unless you're talking about, there's a guy named Mr. Big, but it has nothing to do with his penis.
Really? Yes. Oh, I guess I know absolutely nothing about that show, and I just assumed that's what that meant.
Yeah, he's just supposed to be like Mr. Big Shot.
Oh.
Yeah, so you'd have lost on Final Jeopardy or something if that was the question that came up. But anyway, let's go into Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which was directed by Nicholas Meyer, aired back on December 6, 1991. This came out before during the fifth season of TNG, if you can believe that.
Wow, fifth season?
Yep, and its screenplay goes to Nicholas Meyer, Denny Martin Flynn, and Shakespeare. So we are going to come back in a second. I'm going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back. We're going to break down the very final TOS movie, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Once again, we've saved civilization as we know it.
And the good news is they're not going to prosecute.
Oh, they might as well have prosecuted me. I felt like Lieutenant Valaris.
Well, they don't arrest people for having feelings.
And it's a good thing, too. If they did, we'd all have to turn ourselves in.
Captain Kirk.
Captain Sulu. As much to the crew of the Enterprise, I owe you my thanks.
Nice to see you in action one more time, Captain Kirk. Take care.
My God, that's a big ship.
Not so big as her captain, I think.
So, this is goodbye.
I think it's about time we got underway ourselves.
Captain, I have orders from Starfleet Command. We're to put back to space dock immediately to be decommissioned.
If I were human, I believe my response would be, go to hell. If I were human.
Course heading, Captain.
Second star to the right. And straight on till morning.
So Nicholas Meyer's back, Clay, and he had been pushing to call Wrath of Khan The Undiscovered Country. He's been pushing for four movies now in what would be like 15 years of time to get a movie named The Undiscovered Country. He really loves it. And maybe it's kind of apropos of this movie that they actually use the phrase incorrectly in the movie. Shakespeare, it's from Hamlet, apparently, and Hamlet's referring to death as the undiscovered country. Mm-hmm. They don't really hear. They seem to think that it's like towards like bridging new friendships and stuff, like the future is kind of the undiscovered country.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to take points away for that. I think they're just using it as a metaphor.
Yes. Yeah. But
I'm not gonna take points away for not going hard and fast by the book.
Well, the way it goes eventually, at the very end of this movie, I think I will hold it against it. I think Chang just eventually stops actually saying lines and just starts saying quotations from Shakespeare at a certain point.
Yeah. I will say they do use it appropriate because this is the most violent Star Trek movie I've ever watched. So there's a lot of characters being sent to the undiscovered country in this episode.
Yeah. What'd you think of the undiscovered country, our final TOS movie? After five, it was kind of a surprise that this movie would be made. Paramount apparently decided that they didn't want five to be the final thing that this crew ever did.
That's fair.
So they came back with a reduced budget, and they brought back Nicholas Meyer to do his thing, as he had been in The Wrath of Khan with a similar situation of a reduced budget. And Leonard Nimoy came up with the idea of, he was watching the news. This is always funny to me that you can get a story credit just by sort of pitching a general idea. Nimoy was watching the news, just saw, you know, the Berlin Wall and communism was falling in the early 90s. And he said, how about we have the wall falls in space, and that'll be the movie. And that's what they did. So what'd you think of The Undiscovered Country?
Well, first, I'd like to come back to the Nimoy thing a little bit later after we're done, because I had some thoughts about him in general. But for the movie, I enjoy this one. I actually saw this in the theater. I remember seeing this in the theater very clearly. And I always liked it. I always thought it was one of the better movies. I haven't watched it in, God, 20 years at least. And watching it again, it's good. I really appreciate, I'm kind of two minds about it, because on the one hand, as a finale, I feel like it's a little bit subdued.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I really enjoy the different tack that they're taking. That it's, you know, Nicholas Meyer, one of the other movies he directed, and I can't remember if he wrote the book. I think it's Time After Time.
Okay.
I believe Sherlock Holmes ends up in the future. I don't know, some sort of time travel thing involving Sherlock Holmes. Anyway, he's a big like older literature file, if you couldn't tell.
Right. Yeah.
And I like that he basically takes the Star Trek movie and kind of turns it into a Sherlock Holmes story to an extent, like even to the point where I think Spock even makes an allusion to the fact that Sherlock is one of his ancestors.
Right. Yep.
So that's fun. I mean, they did it on the show on TNG a bunch, where you'd have some sort of like murder mystery thing going on, but they never did. I don't think they ever really did it as well in TOS as they do here.
Yeah.
Cause it's the story's interesting. I like the political stuff. But I feel like it's a little bit lacking as a finale. It doesn't feel like it's big enough. And I know I generally think that there is no reason why you need to, like, big needs to mean like explosions and stuff. Like, you can have a big story that doesn't necessarily involve the fate of the universe or whatever.
Right.
But I think the thing that's bugging me about this movie is that for as much as there is great stuff that the characters do, they really kind of balk at doing stuff with the characters, if that makes sense. Like, it's not really a character movie.
No, it's not.
You're not getting... I thought they were going to go into it more. Like, I love the stuff with Kirk. I was going to mention at the top that... was Gene Roddenberry dead at this point?
Yes, he was dead when it aired. He saw the movie finished before he died, but... I think
the movie probably killed him.
Okay.
Because... this is probably the least Gene Roddenberry of all of the original movies.
Yeah, apparently Meyer and Roddenberry did not get along very well.
That doesn't surprise me whatsoever.
They had a lot of meetings that ended with one of them storming out of the room after a while. And Nicholas Meyer had some funny thing about... Roddenberry had said something critical about the movie or something like that. And Nicholas Meyer said that, you know, he had the typical comeback, like he can talk after he's done, like, you know, cashing the check of all the money that I've made him.
Yeah.
And yeah, they didn't get along. And I think they have a very different perspective on what Star Trek is. Meyer definitely has a vision for it because he hasn't been directing since Wrath of Khan. Right. Mm-hmm. But this movie to me feels much almost like it takes place right after Wrath of Khan because he kind of ignores everything that happened after that. Like he ignores the search for Spock aspect because this is the first movie that, like, you know, David plays a big role again. You can tell that Meyer really wanted that relationship to be something.
Right.
And here it's the entire basis for what I think is kind of one of the bigger problems of the movie is that, to me, the delay between Meyer being in Wrath of Khan and directing this movie is that it kind of feels like all the characters' sense of the conflict that they're in doesn't feel right because it doesn't take place right after Wrath of Khan in a lot of ways. Like, they're very hostile towards the Klingons in a way that I don't think they've ever been before. The Klingons have always been kind of just more of a nuisance type thing here as opposed to, like, this sort of racism type angle that a lot of people in the Federation seem to have towards them.
Right.
The movie actually has that weird thing at the beginning where they, when the Klingons are considering a truce, a peace treaty, they're having a discussion about whether or not to fold Starfleet as if the only thing that Starfleet does is defends against the Klingons.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was thinking, like, Roddenberry must have had an aneurysm when he saw that.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, we had talked a little bit about how the new show, Discovery, they just made an announcement that they're ditching the old no conflict among characters thing,
right. Yep.
Even though they kind of basically already did. This movie ditches that hard. Like, all of those things that you know, we've heard up to this point that Roddenberry did not want are is basically in this movie. And, you know, I don't mind the shift in tone towards the Klingons because, you know, I think it makes sense for the story that they're trying to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think this story works with any other alien race.
No, you have to have that history.
Yeah, and if you wanted to have that sort of relationship, I don't think it would work with Romulans. I don't think it would work if you created a new thing or whatever. Yeah. But I don't mind it because, like, I'm willing to believe, knowing, you know, how humans are, that that mindset has always been there. It just not necessarily was on the surface.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, what he did in Wrath of Khan, where he kind of took away some of the idealism of the concept, he kind of strips it away even further. But but to be fair, by the end of it, it is very much. It very much kind of reinstates the core idea of what the Star Trek thing is.
Yes.
So yeah. I think I like it because it breaks it down on the surface, but by the time you get to the end, it sort of it reaffirms everything that you kind of come to expect.
Yes. Yeah. I'd agree with that, and I think that one of the sort of the tone here, you know, you mentioned it in the previous podcast. I think how far are you willing to take something and change it, you know, for it to still be acceptable in terms
right.
of what it is.
Right.
I feel this is almost that far in terms of Star Trek.
Really? Okay.
Because just basically because I don't think the movie really is a huge success across anything that it does, but I don't think any of it is particularly bad at the same time. Like, it's always sold as sort of the uncovering, like the political thriller of the Star Trek movies.
Right.
And I don't think it's a particularly good thriller in any way. Like, someone, I was reading a review, someone wrote the conspiracy is basically Scooby-Doo villain level conspiracy.
Yeah. Yes.
And I feel that that's very true. And it also, I'm kind of annoyed by the end of it, because it's at the end of it, it's revealed that all these traitors, right, are people who are in the Federation. And a lot of them are characters who have been in the movies for a long time. That Black Admiral has been in a lot of the movies. And it kind of feels a little bit, it's a little bit weird to me that it ends with so many of them betraying the Federation in a way. Like it doesn't feel earned. I wouldn't mind Valeris being that person, although Valeris was supposed to originally be Savick.
Really? That would be
better?
Interesting. I don't know. I don't think that's really earned. It's such a... Like, if you did that to Savick, that would be very out of the blue, and it wouldn't feel right.
It would, although I think the problem with Valeris is that it's like, oh, there's a conspiracy. It's probably the person we've never seen before but seems to have an important role in this movie. You know, it's that kind
That's
of...
That's true.
Savick would hide it a little bit better, I think.
Yeah.
I think that the movie's very much enjoyable, but I think that it's like the conspiracy doesn't really hold together. Like, the sort of figuring out the conspiracy is not a lot of detective work on their part. It's interesting, but it's not particularly good.
And it's basically just looking in drawers.
Right, until they find
It's like the detective equivalent of me trying to find my remote.
Yes, yeah, it's like, where are the keys? Oh, here they are. These keys don't actually fit in my car. There must be another key somewhere. And I actually don't like I don't like any of the gulag stuff.
Yeah, that stuff, you know, that's stuff to me feels out of place.
And how so?
Like, I was thinking about this as I was watching it, and I find it a little bit hard to sort of express, but there's like, I think I felt a little bit of the same thing in Five, where I feel like there's a certain set of, and I kind of talked about this as, I don't know if it's just because 2, 3, and 4 have such similar imagery that when you get to 5, it feels kind of jarring.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt kind of the same way here, where there's so much in it that is recognizable and feels like Star Trek to me, like what my understanding of the original series cast and movies of Star Trek is. But when you get to the gulag stuff, for whatever reason, it just feels out of place to me. I don't know if it's the fact that it's Kirk and McCoy in this place, or I don't know what it is, but it doesn't feel right, and I'm not sure why I can't really explain it.
To me, there's a couple of things going on. To me, the theme is almost too heavy-handed throughout this movie. Like, the fact that they call it a gulag is excessive, you know. Yeah. What I mean, like, there's so much direct correlation to the fall of communism in the late 80s. Like, Spock has a line about Nixon going to China or something like that. It's like, why does he know that reference? And
there's a lot of weird quotations that you don't think people should know. This movie.
Right. It's a very...
Maybe only Nixon can go to China is from the original Vulcan translation.
But it's a lot of that, like a lot of, clearly, I mean, it was a huge seminal moment in world history, so it was clearly on these people's minds who are making this movie. I just feel like they focused on it a little bit too much, to a little bit of a detriment. So that's kind of the gulag problem. And then my other problem with the gulag is that it feels to me like it's really just wasting time, because nothing really happens there. Kirk doesn't – I wouldn't say that Kirk takes an active role in his escape or anything. You know, he follows that changeling around, and then he gets away and they beam him off because Spock put a tracking device on him or something. It just feels to me like 15 minutes of killing time while the Enterprise is trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think the thing that bothers me, I think the reason it doesn't work for me, is that exactly what you're saying. It's just wasting time, and Kirk's character, he has that one bit where he's, you know, asleep or whatever, or they're sleeping, and he's talking to McCoy about, you know, how he didn't even ask he didn't even consider for a second believing the guy, but the setting in which all this is happening means absolutely nothing. It's just like it's a very much like an outline plot point. And I think, you know, what I was saying earlier about it not being about the characters, I think this is a good example, because, so just to back up a little bit, like, one of the things that I got really excited about was at the beginning, there is a rift between Spock and Kirk. Like, they lean into that a little bit, where Spock is very much for reconciliation with the Klingons, and Kirk is very much against that, and Spock kind of speaks for Kirk, and he doesn't like... So there's a lot of... They actually butt heads, which I was psyched about, because I thought I didn't remember that. So
you had mentioned it in previous episodes, too.
Yeah, it was the last one, I think, was I was wishing they'd done that. And so I was hoping they were going to... You know, that was going to be a running theme through the thing, but again, they don't really do anything with it. And I think... as far as the Gulag goes, I think that whole character move would have been better if he had been, like, among the Klingons.
Sure.
You know, like, if they had been imprisoned on Kronos or something, where he is put among the Klingons. You know, where there's some sort of more thematic...
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah. You know, coming to know the enemy, almost.
Yeah, or at least put him in a situation where he's dealing with stuff we care about or people that we care about.
Sure.
Instead of just, like, the equivalent of that scene from the J.J. Abrams one where he's on the ice planet and he runs from the giant monster and he literally back somersaults into old man Spock.
There's a thing. Whenever Star Trek shows too many varieties of aliens at a time, it feels very Star Warsy. Star Warsy thing to do, to have a bunch of just weird aliens in a room.
Yeah, that's another thing that put me off, and I think I felt that way in the last one too, but it really kind of stuck out in this one because there's a lot of them.
Yes,
right. And it feels, because I was thinking to myself, it's like, well, that feels really strange for Star Trek, but they do have a lot of different alien races, obviously, because they're meeting different ones every week, but you don't usually see them en masse,
right,
like you do here.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's necessary. Like, I'm not sure where to fall on that, because it does feel very Star Wars, but at the same time, it's like, well, in the show, we don't have the budget to show. You know, like, it's like they want to be more egalitarian.
Yeah.
But they don't have the money to do it, so when they do the movies, well, they may as well show some aliens, which I guess makes sense.
I think that it's a Star Warsy thing that they should try to avoid, mostly because the Star Wars universe to me feels more like people travel between planets a lot more.
Yes.
And Star Trek always feels like it's societies. Like, societies are kind of messed together, and you'll occasionally have, like, you know, visitors and stuff like that, but you never just have this hodgepodge of, like, bounty hunters and stuff in one place.
Star Wars has, I don't think they have any delineation of distance between anything.
Right, yeah.
Whereas Star Trek is very much like, oh, well, that's going to be 2 days and 100,000 light years or whatever it is. You know, there's a very finite idea of distance between places they're going.
And
whereas Star Wars is just like, well, if we zip around space for 10 minutes, we'll end up on a planet that's entirely a swamp.
And something I never thought about, there's no races in Star Wars that don't have light speed. You know, there's no distinction there. Which is kind of...
That's not like a achievement like it is in Star Trek.
Right, yeah. So the Gulag just kind of strikes me the wrong way. Leading up to it, I really enjoy the Klingon trial, though.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Featuring Michael Dorn, which is a nice sort of tie-in there, playing his great-grandfather in canon, Colonel Worf.
Do you think Patrick Stewart wrote a letter to Nicholas Meyer and was like, what if we also see Captain Picard's grandfather in a very prominent role?
You know, I never really appreciated how late this movie was in terms of all the Star Trek. Like, I was thinking that Star Trek V came out during TNG's second season, right? Was that the worst year for Star Trek?
Yeah, it might have been.
In this one, Undiscovered Country came out during season 5, which is a very good season of TNG. Is this one of the best years of Star Trek?
Arguably, yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's the timing of everything works out, and you run into, when I was reviewing it, a lot of little trivias, like McCoy, or DeForest Kelly, rather, had been on TNG because he was in the pilot, but that was filmed before this, so this is his, like, last appearance, even though, you know, chronologically in the series, he appears much later on and stuff like
that. Right. It was the 25th anniversary, so they hit it pretty hard.
Yes, and that's another reason why they wanted the movie to come out, is to sort of represent that and everything.
I will say, I know you said this about the last one, but I could really feel the age in this one.
Yes,
like, they felt really like it. Like but in the last one,
that feels appropriate, though. I think in this movie, right?
Yeah. Yes, and no. Because in the last one, I feel like part of the story was kind of that it was a little bit weird that they were throwing everybody back together on the ship.
I felt that way in every single movie since The Wrath of Khan, I think.
Yeah.
I don't really understand why they're all still serving together.
Yeah. Like, this one, it really stood out to me. It's like, why the hell are they still doing this?
Right.
I know I saw an interview with the screenwriter, and he originally had an opening sequence where basically everybody on the ship had retired and were working regular, normal jobs.
Sure.
And hating it. And it was sort of like the first act of the movie was getting the crew back together.
Oh, right.
Which I don't think they need to do that. But it's an interesting idea because it kind of at least kind of – I don't know if it's better to draw attention to it or not to. But, like, man, every time someone was in, like, direct light, I was like, man, they look so old.
Yeah, they do look very old. And it's – I think it fits just because you know that going in, like they mentioned early on that this is the last. Spock has the scene we're talking about, like he's going to retire after this mission and everything. Like I appreciate that the movie knows that this is the end, and it just they don't do the Wrath of Khan trick at the end of like leaving a little breadcrumb for you just in case we want to come back and do another movie. Here's what we're going to do. They go off into this movie knowing that this is going to be the last one, and it's funny you mentioned that they wanted to do the opening scene differently because I think this actually has the best opening scene out of any of the movies.
Oh, with
Praxis exploding and
yeah,
the shockwave.
Yeah. I mean, it was nice to see at least Sulu got a promotion.
Right.
He's, I don't know. Apparently Chekhov is too much of a fuck up to get out of the bridge of the Enterprise,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, Chekhov had his own command before, I thought, and now he seems to be back on the Enterprise. What did you think about separating Sulu? It's necessary for the plot, but I don't know if it was as fulfilling as
yeah,
I would have wanted.
I think it would have worked better if there was some sort of like the crew had been scattered. You know, like it was just Sulu, so it felt sort of weird.
Yeah.
But if it had been some sort of thing where it's like, oh, Scotty is off on this ship, or like he's stuck on the space station, they got to get him. You know, like there was no. It seemed like everybody was still hanging around having a good time except for Sulu, who decided he wanted to go to college.
Right, yeah, know? Yeah.
And it was – I think it worked. It was a little bit of a bummer for that last shot because everybody's there, but Sulu's chair is just like a destroyed chair.
Yeah, and he checks in on the view screen. Yeah, it is weird that he's not on the bridge. Like, shouldn't the logical thing to do would be I think he's in command of the Excelsior. The Excelsior would be destroyed,
yeah.
Right? Like, and he would be beamed on the Enterprise. That would be the way that I would get around it.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, the Excelsior just flips off. And speaking of the Excelsior, the effects in this one are so much better than in 5. It's like ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
The ships actually look nice in this one, and the explosion works and everything like that.
Yeah, they upgraded I think they redesigned the bridge of the Excelsior too, because it looked a lot better than it did in 3.
When it was the chasing one, that's right. So I get I guess we'll focus a little bit on we talked about how this one is like the real world politic, like the real politic or whatever they call it of the movies. I feel that this one is, if the motion picture didn't exist, this one is the most unique in tone out of all the movies in a lot of ways, in my opinion. And,
yeah, I'd agree.
So did you say that you liked the way that they took this in terms of like taking like a real life thing and sort of turning Star Trek and Star Trekizing it?
Yeah, I did. Because I like, you know, the show itself was born out of the Cold War, really,
mm-hmm.
And to not address the fall of the Soviet Union in Star Trek, I think would be a really missed opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like that they did that. It probably is a little bit too on the nose in some spots. I'm surprised that the Klingons didn't have some sort of wall they needed to take down at the end.
Yeah, this is a galactic barrier. I mean, it's also what's kind of nice about it is that it is referencing the fall of communism, and the Klingons were always stand-ins for the Soviets in the '60s mm-hmm. TV show.
Gorbachev's character is basically named I just said Gorbachev.
Yeah, his
name, David Warner's character is basically like the Klingon translation name of Gorbachev.
Yep, he's Chancellor Gorkon, which is a nice take on that. The other thing that's kind of nice and that's kind of thematically dovetails nicely is that TNG had already come out, so Worf is already on the Enterprise. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they hadn't dealt with how that would actually happen at that point. So this is kind of a necessary movie to link the two series together.
Which is nice, because I don't think I realized before that, they came up with the Klingons now being part of the Federation thing way before this movie even existed.
Right.
And so it makes sense that they would actually show you bits of that, which is a nice bridge.
It is. I think that the movie works really well as a bridge between the series in a lot of ways, and I appreciate it for that.
Not to jump too far ahead, but it actually might have been a better idea to use for Generations, to have some aspect of that core principle of the TNG be involved in whatever story they end up telling in Generations. But then,
Yes, we'll
get to that.
We'll be getting to that. But I think they did a good job here in terms of doing that, in terms of linking everything like that. So we can talk about I think that the best part of this movie is actually the first hour of it.
I would say everything up through the
Gulag,
the Klingon trial, I think is really good.
Yes, yeah, I would agree with that as well. And I think that you mentioned that it sort of resumes its Star Trekiness towards the end, and I think that's kind of where it slightly loses steam for me, because it's much darker in the opening.
It resumes its Star Trekiness in theme, I think,
sure,
and tone. It does have the problem of I feel like there's a certain kind of third act in some action movies where it just feels like people running around.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of what this feels like at the point towards the end. You know, like it kind of suffers from the fact that the crew is all involved. So it's like a lot of shots of the entire crew like running around.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of weird. And, I appreciate what they're going for, but the stakes feel really low for some reason. Just at the end there.
Oh, just at the end, I see.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something about that final sequence, which I know it's a big deal because they're about to assassinate a president, but it feels sort of redundant given what happened in the first half.
Yes. I think the problem with the ending is almost that they throw too much into it and it almost confuses everything. Like, I don't understand why the Federation guy, like, why he dresses up as a Klingon. Why they didn't just have a Klingon do it? Because they're working with the Klingons, aren't they?
Wait, what? There's a Federation guy dressed as a Klingon?
Yeah, at the very end, the Klingon that gets shot out of the thing.
He's a human?
Yeah, he's the colonel from the beginning.
When do they show you that?
It's like they reveal he's got like a mask. There are multiple versions of this movie. Did that not happen in yours?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was kind of weird because he falls out of the window.
Yep.
And then someone goes over to check on him and like it looked like they were pulling something out of his neck.
Yes, they pull his mask off.
I am almost positive that scene is not in there, but If it is, I shut my eyes or something because I do not remember that at all.
Do you remember at the very opening, there's like a mustached admiral talking to Kirk and Spock? It's Rene Auberjonois who plays Odo in Deep Space Nine, but he's the actor.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, and
no, I do not remember that either.
Yeah, for some reason, he is dressed as a Klingon who's going to commit the assassination at the end. Although, can you tell me, is Chang, the Klingon Chang, is he working with the Federation traitors?
I think so.
So the internal logic doesn't make a lot of sense to me because the Federation people who are the traitors are doing this conspiracy because they say that the Klingons can't be trusted. However, their entire plot relies on them trusting a Klingon to do something. And I don't understand sort of the motivations for everyone doesn't make a lot of sense. And it just ties into the ending where I don't understand why he has to dress up like a Klingon. to do this.
Yeah, you're making me feel crazy because I do not remember that guy at all. I know that actor, and I am 100% sure I did not see him in this movie.
Okay.
Is there like a director's cut or something?
There is. I know there's a version. I think that's – I didn't know how big of a difference it is, but there is a version where that character is more prominent, and I think it's just the beginning and the ending that he's in.
Huh. I'll have to go back and check because I don't remember that at all.
And yeah, I mean
– I do remember Kurtwood Smith though.
I think the movie actually might go downhill when they reveal Kurtwood Smith because he looks fucking ridiculous.
Yeah. What is he supposed to be? Is he supposed to be some just unidentified alien or is he supposed to be a Klingon?
I think he's unidentified alien, but he looks like a Klingon with a Fu Manchu basically. Yeah.
He kept his glasses from RoboCop though, with the sweet circle glasses.
Lawrence Boddicker, you're coming with me.
Clarence Boddicker.
Clarence. I wrote Lawrence on the thing, but it's Clarence. It's a better name. But yeah, so you didn't particularly like the ending. You thought it was too redundant of everything you'd seen before, and you didn't need this assassination attempt going
on. Yeah, because you've got – I mean, your setup for your whole plot is that this leader who's in charge of peace gets assassinated. And then the next step in the mechanism, the downward hill of your roller coaster is that – oh, well, we're just going to go kill another guy.
Yeah.
Like, there should be – I don't know why they didn't do it more like the Klingons and the Federation are now on the brink of war. Like, why didn't they treat it like World War One? Where Archduke Ferdinand gets assassinated. So that's the spark in the powder keg that's going to set off this cold war is now just heated up. That kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
Instead of it's just like – the Cold War is now slightly more lukewarm, but not really because the Klingons don't have a moon anymore, and they're going to run out of energy. And there's the stakes get really vague after that point.
Yes,
like
yeah,
up through the first assassination, everything's very very clear.
Yep.
But then towards the end, it's just like I don't know.
It feels like a lot of stuff just being sort of thrown at the wall. That's what it feels like to me, in my opinion.
Yeah, like if you had not to completely fantasy football this movie, but like if you had took at the Gulag stuff and had Kirk on Kronos, you could have him there seeing the mechanisms of what was happening. Like you could push that the Klingons were now preparing for war, but they are severely debilitated, so they're going to be wiped out. Like something like that, where the stakes of what's going on would be a little bit more heavy than just like, well, we killed one guy, but now we're going to kill this other guy. Because after a movie where a lot of people get killed, that doesn't really have as much weight.
I think that kind of ties into what I was thinking about how close it hems to the Soviet Union collapse, right? Because in my opinion, it almost feels vaguely un-Klingon-y that so many of the Klingons are willing to sort of reconcile with the Federation over this. So, the Soviet Union was in different state where Gorbachev obviously came in and sort of worked with Reagan to sort of end all of this. And he was willing to sort of break apart the Soviet Union in a lot of ways that feels historically appropriate, but it doesn't really feel appropriate to the Klingons in a lot of ways. Do you think that the movie is saying that most of the Klingon people are for this, or is this sort of a last gasp by the politics of the Klingon Empire? Do you know what I mean? Like, do you feel like this is the movie? Does the movie sell to you that this is what the Klingon people actually want, or is this more of a desperation type move on their part?
I don't think it really sells you on it.
Okay,
because I don't think you get enough of an idea of what the Klingon people do want.
Right, and I think you've got your Kirk idea would remedy that if they moved Kirk to Kronos.
Yeah, because you've got the only Klingons you see giving an opinion are David Warner. Who clearly wants peace and gets killed.
Yes, yep.
And Christopher Plummer, who clearly does not want peace and kills him. But everybody in the middle, I mean, you've got David Warner's daughter, but she's basically as if David Warner hadn't been killed.
I was a little surprised that she doesn't have any sort of duplicity too
well. Yeah, me too. I was expecting that, yeah. I couldn't remember who was... I knew Christopher Plummer obviously was involved, as if the eye patch and the Shakespeare quoting didn't tip you off that he was a bad guy.
Right.
It actually probably... You know what? It would have been more of a novel approach if she had been involved and Christopher Plummer had not been involved.
Probably, yeah.
Like, if it turned out that Christopher Plummer actually helped Kirk defeat this, that would be more... Because isn't that more of a... Wouldn't that be more of an interesting statement to make anyway? To have your Klingon character who's supposed to be like the analog of Kirk, who's the person bred for war, and that's the only thing the only life he knows is war. Wouldn't it be a more interesting, hopeful point to make that this is the guy who is accepting that things are changing and moving forward and the same way that Kirk has to?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the way that you, I guess you could tie that in is that, you know, I've just been reading a lot. I read a book recently about the Cold War, so it's interesting to like compare this to what the movie is talking about. But, you know, a lot of U.S. and Soviet relations were mostly difficult because we'd always end up with one of the two leaders would always be a hardliner. So right. Reconciliation was never possible. And you ended up like, it kind of worked out together where Reagan was very hardline, but one of the best things about him was that he was able to recognize that Gorbachev was not hardline about these kind of things. And he kind of yielded to him. And so that allowed the peace to come. And I think that they don't really play around with the fact of the differing hardliner and the Gorkon type characters. Like Chang could be the hardliner type character who
right.
eventually comes around to it or something like that. And, you know, you're actually a little bit limited because these movies, the TOS movies, still don't deal with the Klingons as they would eventually become this like honor society.
Yeah, yeah.
So they don't have a lot there's no internal motivation for them. Like there would be in TNG, where the honorable thing to do is this, and there's always the Klingons who are dishonorable and they are trying to do something else and stuff like
that. It's kind of interesting that they didn't fold that in to this, because you're in season 5 of TNG, so that's been well established.
Yes, yeah.
So I don't know why you don't just kind of do a light retcon and just, you know, why
yeah,
not?
Dust it. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Let's talk about the Klingons, and indirectly that means, is this the best cast out of any of the movies?
Probably, yeah. I mean, as far as you're talking like villains or just the Klingons?
Just everybody. I think that there's a lot of good actors in this movie. I mean, there's the cast, obviously. But then you have Plummer, David Warner, Kim Cattrall. You have Red Foreman, you know, Clarence Boddicker. Mm-hmm. I just feel like there's, even though the president role isn't important, he's a good actor to have in that role. And I just feel like they sort of stacked the deck with the Klingon actors could probably not be cast any better, I don't think, as to what their roles are.
Christopher Plummer is awesome.
Yeah.
The only problem I was going to ask you about this, about his character in general, I think he's great, but I feel like he's basically just a Klingon version of Khan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
sort of.
Not, and like,
right down to the quoting.
Yeah,
literature.
it's like more of that. If not the motivation, just the attitude. Like it's almost like their speech patterns are almost identical too. Like the way that they, I mean, maybe that's just classical training or something.
Yeah,
like that.
But yeah. Well,
when a classical actor gets his hands on a Melville quote, it's just like the scenery turns into cheeseburgers.
I probably would have felt even more that he was Connie. If the problem with Chang to me is that he feels all like he's style and no substance. I don't really understand how involved he is in any of the plot that's going on. He's there obviously through the beginning and you feel like he's going to be a big important part of it, but they eventually just relegate him to being on the cloaked bird of prey quoting Shakespeare nonstop. Like he doesn't have any sort of thing going on outside of that, which is surprising because he seems leading into that as if he's going to be the intellectual like Khan is. Khan's super intelligent in addition to being, you know, super strong and all that stuff, but Chang never really fulfills that role of being the intellectual equal of anybody.
Right. Which is why it would have been nice if they had given him a twist at the end.
Yeah.
Because
he's
not really involved with anything. You know, he's the villain because he acts like one, really.
Right.
You know, I don't mean, obviously, he's the villain because he acts like a villain. But you know what I mean. He's playing a villain, like in the capital V sense of the word.
Yeah.
And the stuff he's actually doing is not really involved with anything. It's just more, it is more show than anything else. Yeah.
I guess moving on from that would just be the sort of, I think that this movie has a lot of, due to the cast and everything like that, I think this movie has a lot of very good scenes in it. Maybe this movie might have more great scenes in it than any of the other movies do, if that makes sense. The dinner party scene is fantastic. Yep. I like the assassination on the Klingon ship scene.
Yeah, I really like that scene a lot. That's very cool. I mean, I've never seen that in any other movie. That's a very cool idea.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat idea to just strand everybody by taking away the gravity and then going in with gravity boots. I like this has, in my opinion, the best battle scene of all the Star Trek movies, I think, at least the original series ones.
As you mean ship battle?
Ship battle, yeah, with the Excelsior and the Enterprise against the cloaked Bird of Prey.
Yeah, that was nice. That was cool. I like the way that they get out of it is nice. It's very clever. I wish they had, unless I missed this as well too, I wish they had given you like a Chekhov's gun situation. I wish they literally gave Chekhov a gun. It seemed weird when they were talking about the gas coming out of the back of the Bird of Prey.
Yeah, yeah.
They figure out what they want to do, and then I forget who it is. It's like, well, it's a good thing we have all that gas detecting equipment on the ship.
Yes. Well, it's the they do sort of set the stage because at the start, the Excelsior has been on a gaseous nebula expedition for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it ties in, I guess. But they're talking about the Enterprise.
The Enterprise doesn't have that. Yeah. So like if they had given you a little bit of a heads up, that might have been a little, it would feel less like writing yourself out of a corner,
right,
sort of.
Yeah.
But I like that. That's very satisfying when they you know, shoot the thing on, you know, the way, you know, Captain Kirk's last fire is a good one.
Yes, that's basically it. The last attack that they have to pull off feels very satisfying. It's like got a good crunch to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like they really light the fuck out of that thing and just let it go. So tying into the Bird of Prey, did you like the way the Bird of Prey and its cloak worked into the mystery? So I guess we'll talk about like the strength of the central mystery for whatever it is for about a half an hour of the movie time where they don't really understand what's going on. Did you feel it was effective or did you think it was a cheat?
I liked it. I thought it was interesting. It was a good way to use that. Cause I think the cloaking device can feel like a cheat, but I thought this was an interesting way to do it. I mean, the only cheat might be that it's not just a cloaked Bird of Prey. It's specifically one that can fire when it's cloaked,
which is
kind of a, you know, another write yourself out of a corner kind of situation. But it is a clever use of that. I enjoyed it.
I thought the best part of the mystery is the fact that they were hit with photon torpedoes, but Scotty repeatedly says that they still have all the photon torpedoes on board.
Yes.
I think that's a nice, like, the ship's computer says that they fired it, but they still have all the torpedoes on board.
Right.
And I think that the scene is another great scene. The scene where they start firing at the ship and the crew are like completely have no idea what's going on about, like they're like, are we firing at it? Like what's happening? I think they play the confusion of that very well. And you can really see how the plot at that point of the conspiracy is probably as strong as it ever would be for the rest of the movie. Like the way they initiate it is the best part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, the one issue I had with the way things kind of play out is when they're on trial, unless maybe I misunderstood what they were saying, but it seemed like they were implying that McCoy and Kirk were actually the ones who killed everybody.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Which, I mean, that would be the easiest thing in the world to disprove.
Yes, it's a little bit of a kangaroo court, but they don't call a witness or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, Kirk and McCoy don't even say that's impossible. I was on the ship the whole time. You know, like that's, right. They don't even say that.
Yeah.
I guess Chang kind of cuts to the bone with the you're responsible for the actions of your crew thing.
Yes,
but I mean they don't even really offer any sort of defense.
No. And
what I'm saying is Worf's grandfather was a shitty lawyer.
He was definitely a public defender who was not worth his salt out there.
He was probably he got his degree in bird law from Klingon. Kronos, excuse me.
Yeah, the
or Kling, depending on what season you're in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've gotten rid of the Kling thing. Fortunately, this is the first time it's actually called Kronos, which is so that's kind of a little bit of trivia for people. But
they should have retconned. It's like, oh yeah, no, it was called Kling, but then our moon blew up, so we had to move to a new planet. That planet's called Kronos.
Right? Yeah. Was it Romulus and Remus? Right. We'll be getting into that in a little bit, but. Yeah, I think that the conspiracy after that part kind of falls apart. The fact that the two killers are basically just two crewmen you see for 3 seconds too long, like the camera lingers on them, so you're like, oh, those guys are clearly up to something.
I thought that was going to be a fake at the end. Like when they find those guys dead, I thought that they weren't actually going to be the ones who did it.
It seemed I felt that way a lot about a lot of the twists that the movie took. It didn't like it sounds like I'm harsh on the political thriller aspect of it is mostly because the movie doesn't fall into the usual tropes of that genre you'd expect.
Right.
But I think at the same time that kind of weakens the thrillerness of it. Does that make sense? If you're watching a thriller, you'd expect those kinds of twists to happen. You need some kind of twist in like these kind of thriller movies, and the movie never really does that.
Yeah, they give you like the first level of twists.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, they don't really give you the good stuff that makes you go, huh?
Right.
In a good way, not a Star Trek 5 way.
Right. And then the conspiracy just all kind of fades away. So I think that we're going to wrap this up before we get to the final topic, which will be the sort of how it fares as a final movie. Let's talk about Valeris, I guess, for a little bit. Mm-hmm. What'd you think? In any way, what'd you think of the performance? What'd you think of the point of the character? And what did you think of the mind meld scene with her?
Yeah, that was interesting. I don't really care for her performance. She's not given really a ton to do. I'm really surprised that, like, the story was that she was the original choice for Savick, but then, you know, couldn't do it for whatever reason, so they got Kirstie Alley, and so now they brought her back. And, like, I don't know what could have been so great about her audition that they would go out of their way to bring her back for this.
Yep.
I don't know. I've never really thought she was a very good actress. Like she's in the only other thing I really know her from. I know she's in Sex and the City, obviously, but the only other thing I really know her from is Big Trouble in Little China. And I think she's the worst part of that movie.
Police Academy.
She was in Police Academy.
Yeah, she's the love interest in Police Academy.
Oh, well, it's been so long.
Obviously,
since
the performance
Academy.
didn't stick.
No, I mean, I worked backwards, and I never made it past 5. So
there's a common. I think there's a good way to break down the reasons that we love the characters of Spock and Sarek, who are played by Nimoy and Mark Leonard. Obviously, I'm not the first person to think this, but it's kind of a common thread. There's two kinds of actors. There are actors who understand how to play Vulcans, and those who don't understand how to play Vulcans.
Yep.
And I think that Cattrall's performance... Oh, there's the thunder that we were talking about.
Holy
Clay.
Shit, that was thunder? I thought your bookcase just fell over.
There's a...
Apparently we have to stop talking about Kim Cattrall's performance.
The gods are angry. Gods are angry. The Cattrall falls into the... She confuses the Vulcans with not having emotions as opposed to suppressing emotion. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that in the performance? I think she plays it kind of like she's supposed to be a robot in the way that she talks and everything.
Yeah, I can see that. I think maybe that might be part of it. It's that when you play a Vulcan as a robot, it never comes off good.
No, and I think that's the genius of the Mark Leonard and Nimoy performance. We talked about that scene in Voyage Home, their final scene together. You can tell they're feeling things, but they can't express them, is the point of their story. You know what
I mean? I don't know how much she was feeling after Spock slipped her a hot Cosby in that bedroom scene. I don't know what he gave her, but
so I don't.
Why is it that like is there? There's like a general implication that Spock is banging all these women.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, there is. I don't. Well, it makes sense in terms of this if it's Savick, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It makes sense there. It almost feels like they couldn't get Savick, and then they just decided not to continue, or they decided to continue with that storyline, and it wouldn't make sense.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's a lot to Valeris. I think that it would have been many times better if it was Savick, even if it would feel like the twist maybe came out of nowhere and wasn't deserved. At least the character would be someone that I'd be familiar with and feel something about.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't go with that just because, I mean, when the main through story of the movie is that Kirk is angry with the Klingons over the death of his son. I really would not believe that Savick
would be the one.
Yeah, when she was – the reason that he's dead is because of her.
Yes.
That's not fair. I shouldn't say that. But he sacrifices himself to save her life, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, like – and the way that she spoke about him is very – you know, she recognized the sacrifice and all that kind of stuff. So it would be – unless that became part of it. I mean, that could be part of it. Like maybe – let's say it is Savick and then she does do all this stuff. I would only buy it if there was a scene – where Kirk brings that up.
Yes, I, you know? I think that they would have to write that justification scene in there is to explain why this would happen, because it would be very unsatisfying if it was just between movies all of a sudden she became a traitor for no particular reason.
Right. Unless she's just mad that because of the Klingons, she was then written off the movies for three movies.
I mean, I suppose her justification would be just that she can't forgive the Klingons for what they did, you know, and she, you could write it as the character of, she knows it's a failing of being a Vulcan that she can't let this grudge go.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I guess I'm thinking of it from a different point of view. Cause I would buy that, but I wouldn't buy her
betraying Kirk.
Teaming up with the Klingons in order to do that.
Right. That's kind of the problem of the conspiracy in general, is I don't understand why the Federation and the Klingons are working together if they hate each other.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. Do you think it's because they didn't want to just have it be the Klingons? Like, because it makes more sense, right, if the people behind the conspiracy are the Klingons who are not
super down psyched. The piece, yeah.
Yeah. That makes more sense than it does for the Federation to actively murder that guy.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think they didn't go that way because that was too obvious? Or like I agree. I don't think they really thought it through entirely.
I think that
it feels weird.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's really just the fact that they're trying to make it a thriller and you need that twist at the end. Like you need something. You need that mystery to be kicked off on the Enterprise, because a lot of the movie is built around examining that mystery as to who's done this. And if it was a Klingon, you're at a point where you're not in TNG yet, so you can't have Klingons on the ship to be betraying people. So I think that they're stuck in that
way.
But
you can have weird dudes with freaky feet.
Yes.
That guy talked like a robot. That was kind of off-putting. When they ask him a question, he's like, yes, what can I do for you? I don't think he got a lot of time with the script before he had to do his line.
And interestingly, his name is Dax, but I don't know if it's ever been, if anyone's written a book confirming that this would be the Dax symbiote from Deep Space Nine. I don't know. His name is Dax. That's the only thing that I can think about for that. But they've never mentioned it, I don't think. So that's a missed opportunity.
I can't confirm or deny because I have no idea what you're talking about.
Sure. And the other sort of little bit of trivia is that there's a Voyager episode that does a little bit of what the Enterprise finale does. You know how the Enterprise finale deals with TNG in a certain way?
I do. It's the only episode of Enterprise I've ever watched.
The Voyager has an episode that they flash back to Sulu doing his thing in this movie. And the episode focuses on what he's up to the entire time.
Is it new footage? Like, did they get George Takei to play Sulu?
Yeah, Takei's in the episode and everything.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I guess I'll be watching one episode of Voyager then.
And that's it. So let's talk about this movie as... Oh, we have to talk about the mind meld scene.
Oh, yeah.
The mind meld scene to me feels like something that's like a... You know, the hot topic would be like a triggering scene. And... The mind meld scene to me, there's a lot of episodes of Star Trek that focus on what people would call sort of mind rape and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I feel that rape is the wrong word to use, although it does fit in some ways, but I think it's like needlessly provocative in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And I have a problem with the scene because I don't really understand the purpose of why it's so violent to her. Because they don't build up a reason as to why it would be in general. And I read a lot of reviews. There's probably about 25 to 30% of the reviews thought that the scene was sort of disgusting. and that it degrades Kirk as a hero by having him order Spock to mind meld with her against her will.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the mind meld is basically just a very harsh interrogation technique. Right?
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing sexual about it, so I have a hard time with the rape term, but I also feel that they don't justify what they're doing well enough. Like, they kind of just do it just to get the information, and I don't feel that the stakes are high enough where Kirk has to consider what he's asking Spock to do.
Yeah, and I mean, I can definitely see why people would find it problematic, but it also, there's never been any sort of, like, gauging of how invasive or how powerful it actually is.
Sure.
So I assumed that the reason she's freaking out is because she was fighting back against it, and he's, you know, he does two hands instead of one.
Right.
Because that's how you can tell how powerful your mind meld is, how many hands you use. But yeah, it is. I agree. It's it is a very. It doesn't feel like something that Kirk would willingly make Spock do.
Right, yeah.
Like, do you think Spock... What about if Spock just does it on his own?
I still think the stakes need to be higher. Like, he's...
Yeah.
There's not enough of a ticking time bomb function because...
Yeah, I agree.
The scene also ends with Spock feeling... He looks sort of disgusted with himself for doing it, but then they drop it immediately. And I think it's just it's not earned, and I think that the scene would be fine if they just made the him having to do that be a little bit more urgent than it actually feels in the movie.
Yeah, and especially if he, you know, if there was some way to, like, if Kirk was like, you know, we've got if it was Spock's idea, and then even Kirk was like, dude, we probably shouldn't do
right.
that. You know,
right.
like yeah. You know, for Spock to really do something that he feels gross about,
but
not that makes the act okay. I don't know.
I feel like if it was Savick, right, you can explore a whole bunch of everything else that he feels through her because she, you know,
right.
You'd flash back to Search for Spock and everything like that. You'd flash back to what might have happened that night where she's talking about Ponfar. It might be, you know, it can reveal emotions. He can't learn a lot from this person because we don't know anything about this character.
Yeah, right.
So it does. Yeah. It doesn't feel like if it was Savick, it would feel more like a personal betrayal on some ways because it's a character that we know and everything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Valeris is just basically a dirty traitor to us at this point, and so you don't feel bad for her.
Yeah, the idea of it being like a mind rape thing, it's like I kind of agree with you where it just feels like more of an enhanced interrogation tactic,
right?
Or
yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, torture, but
yeah,
like it's like what? So he does what he does, right? Would it be better if Chekhov had just like put a roll of dimes into a sock and just started hitting her with it until she told him?
Right.
Like, I don't know. Like, it's gross either way, but I don't think that any other. I guess the argument there would be that, well, maybe theoretically they shouldn't do any of that stuff.
Right,
but.
Yeah. That's the argument, but I don't buy that argument either. Like, they clearly need to do something. Even though the movie doesn't do a good job of explaining the stakes to you, they still need to do something in this part. And in my opinion, I'd agree that what they do is certainly less violent than just beating the shit out of her to make her talk and stuff like
that. Like, unless the door opens and Rear Admiral Jack Bauer comes in with a... with a car battery and some exposed wires.
I could just think of the South Park episode where Santa gets captured in Iraq or whatever, and they have to go in. They shocked Santa's balls. They had to die. Yeah, that's Valera. So let's wrap this up with where the movie stands as a final movie for the crew. You had mentioned a little bit earlier, you thought it didn't really excel in that regard.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to start this by saying this is a better wrap-up than Nemesis will be when we get to it, but I still feel... I still feel that... I feel that the ending scene here is not long enough.
Specifically the bridge scene?
Yeah, the bridge scene where he says, the second star from the right and stare down until morning or whatever the hell he says.
I really like that. I
like the line, but I need more time with those people. I needed more lines of dialogue between all of them, I think.
Yeah, I agree to an extent. I think it feels a little forced when they do that stuff a lot. Like when you've got your final episode or whatever and you have that scene where it's like everybody's standing in a circle, so everybody just right. kind of, you know, like that stuff yep. always feels kind of forced.
And that's what Nemesis does, actually.
Oh, do they? Because I was thinking, the reason I would say Nemesis works a little bit better is because there is the finality of you know, there is a permanent change made to the crew.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep, yep.
In a way that hasn't been made in any of these, well, except for the one where they did that and then they reversed it. but, you know, like, I like it. My feelings about it as a finale in general are, like, I almost would rather have the fifth one as the finale,
mm-hmm.
But just executed better.
Sure.
Because, like, it feels like ideally my finale for something like this would be something that really gets to the core. I guess it's my thing with all of this stuff is like the ones that stand out, I feel, and are the most important should be the ones that are the most illustrative. Is that a word?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Illustrative.
Of the core idea of the show.
Mm.
And like having the last mission that they go on being something with a little bit more weight to it, or a little bit headier would have been nice.
Yeah.
You're thinking about things like it's really great that what they actually do is really great. On paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
What they actually achieve is good, and you know, blah blah blah, and tearing down the wall and all that stuff. but like just as you know, having the crew of your ship on the bridge staring down the unknown of whatever this thing, like that's what I feel like should have been the real finale. You
yes,
know?
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think
so. Like, for I'm changing the rest of this movie. I may as well change the end. So this is how it should have ended, right? They're back there on the Enterprise, and then they're all getting ready to go. And then the door opens. Sulu comes in. He's like, "Hey guys, the Excelsior needs repair, so I figured I'd chill out here for a while." And so he's on there. They're all having drinks and they're flying through space. And then they're all sitting around a table and they all get their last lines of dialogue. And then Red Alert goes on and they run into the bridge and they all look out the window and they go, "Holy shit, it's V'ger. He's back." And that's the end.
I think that would it would
time is a flat circle, Wes.
Yeah, it would certainly come back to us at the very beginning there. I think that I was with you until V'ger appeared there, but I think that would certainly be the ending.
No, I actually liked, you know, I got slightly emotional at the Sulu Captain Kirk sign off kind
was
of thing.
Good.
I really liked that.
Yeah.
I feel like that was good. I liked the second star to the right thing. I thought that was great. I think, you know what I think would have made that scene a little bit better for you? If they had, instead of just doing the straight shot of the bridge with everybody on it, if they had done some sort of like going to each person as they're doing their function kind
yes.
of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of, that would take the place of my line of dialogue. It doesn't even need to be dialogue. It just needs to, you need to spend a few seconds with each of them.
Yeah. And, yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And then at the end, Scotty's like, "Oh, I guess I should go back to the engine room because there's no reason for me to be on the bridge."
Right.
I do have to say, overall, I thought this was probably, next to Khan, the best movie for the rest of the crew.
Yes. Next to Khan, you say?
Yeah.
You'd say,
yeah.
You wouldn't say Voyage Home?
Oh, shit. That's what I meant.
Okay,
Voyage Home.
Okay, yeah. Right. Yes.
Yeah, I think this is the best movie for the rest of the crew. Like, I kind of go by like how much dialogue Nichelle Nichols has,
yeah.
and what the substance is, and she's good in this. She's got stuff to do. She comes up with the gas thing, more or less,
yep.
or the solution there.
Yep.
And yeah, I thought it was good. I thought overall, like, a lot of Scotty stuff, A lot of Chekhov stuff. Chekhov kind of sucks, huh?
Chekhov does suck.
Yeah. I never really thought about it before because he was so much like part of, he's like Ringo a little bit where he's part of it, but everybody's like, eh, nah, Ringo.
Yeah, we got to take him. See, I think that this movie and Voyage Home are the only movies that do the other crew any kind of justice whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me because I feel like you end up, in a larger sense, talking about all of these, I feel like the pattern that I've found is you either have to focus on one character or like one or two characters, and that allows you to really get into like the character stuff.
Yeah.
Or you focus on everybody and you kind of sacrifice, you're sacrificing your character work for the sake of everybody having something to do and plot along.
It's more of you either have a character story and an adventure story.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I mean, that's not bad. I mean, I don't know.
I think that I'm glad that the crew had a lot to do here. I mean, one thing that I've sort of noticed is that it's a huge difference between this series and the other series in terms of, like, if I had to ask you to define Uhura, to, like, write up a character sketch about her, like, what mm-hmm. does she think and everything, you would have nothing on her, right? Like, you know nothing about this character other than her job. You know what I mean?
I mean, she has a future in desert feather dancing.
Yes, that. And I mean, I think that the way that it goes would be Kirk, McCoy, Spock, you know the most about them. And then I think Scotty is actually the next person that you know anything about.
He's the only person you know has next of kin.
Right. Yeah. You know, he's an alcoholic in these series and everything like that. And like, you know, stuff like that, but you.
And he got the clap on shore leave after one of the movies.
You know next nothing about Uhura, Sulu, and Chekhov. They're basically just blank slates.
You know Chekhov can't read a map.
That's true. And he is terrible at realizing that the ship can sense when snow is coming down and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's pretty much it. I think I'd agree with you about the wrap-up and everything. I think it's a pretty effective wrap-up. I think it could have been a little bit better, but it's one of those things that probably, if they changed everything the way I wanted, I'd probably complain about it that way if I came out that way, and I'd say that they should have done it the way that they did it here and stuff like that. Yeah, that's pretty much it. So I'm going to just do my final ranking. I've realized that the 1 to 5 doesn't really work in the movies as much as it works in the series. The series are a little bit more consistent. It's easier to rank them on like a 1 to 5 scale. Right. So I'm just going to rank them against each other. I'll go first, and then you can sort of tell me where you think I've gone wrong and everything. So the worst movie to me is still Search for Spock. Mm-hmm. Then Final Frontier is the next worst. Then Motion Picture. So I generally fall into the odd number movies are the worst movies.
Yep.
After that, it would be this one, 6. Then 2, Wrath of Khan, then Voyage Home. So Voyage Home, Wrath of Khan, and this movie are my favorite of the original TOS movies.
Yeah, I would go... I would just rank them in order of their... Basically, I would go 2, 4, 6, 1, 1, 3, 5 is how I'd order it.
Okay, that makes sense. So you like Voyage Home better than this movie?
Oh, yeah. I think it's much more enjoyable, and it's much more successful. And I think my memory of this one is better than it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah.
That being said, I think there's good stuff in it. You know, like we said, like the first hour or so is pretty solid. I just wish they had committed to the, you know, they did 3 seasons of television and 6 movies, and you never really had a substantial fight between Spock and Kirk.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, and I don't know if that's by design. You know, you get to a point where you want to do something, and the actors are like, well, my character would never do that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like they touched on it a little bit in here. This would have been the movie to do it.
Yes.
You know, because Spock is moving in a much more ambassadorial, if that's a word, role.
Yeah, he's preparing for retirement, right? He's kind of greasing the wheels for that.
Yeah, and Kirk is still holding on. Like, in Wrath of Khan, the whole thing is that Kirk's getting old, and, you know, he's still holding on to he's an admiral, he wants to be back on the ship. Like, there's no real exploration of the next part of that, where you've been holding on to your youth so long that it's
awkward.
you really gotta give it up.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
And so when you've got Spock adjusting and accepting the fact that things are moving on. And Kirk, I want to say he doesn't, but they don't really talk about it at all. Like, you don't really get a sense of where he is mindset-wise as far as that goes.
No,
like you get the idea that he's a dying breed. He's a warrior of the Cold War, and once that's over, he's not going to have anything to do.
Yes, yeah.
But you don't get really – you get less of that from him than you do from the Klingons.
Yeah, well, I think I'd say it's almost more – Kirk feels to me like he's more meshed into the culture that's changing and the culture is shifting as opposed to Kirk the person is changing whatsoever.
Yeah.
In a weird way to me, it almost feels like – I almost feel like Kirk is underserved in this movie in a little bit of that way.
I would say so. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Like, I think he – I love this – I really do love the stuff with him and hating the Klingons. I know that it's not something that they ever really leaned into before, but I really like that stuff. I think it's an interesting way to go with him. It's like it's a choice that is – completely weighted by everything that's happened in the movies and the show.
Yeah.
Like, this is a decision. This is the mindset of someone who's been dealing with these people who are his enemy for 35 years or however long he's been in Starfleet. And I completely buy that that's – and they killed his son. I completely buy that that's his real personal take on everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I just wish they had pushed it a little bit further and given – some more conflicting ideologies to deal with instead of just, you know, kicking a guy in his knee balls or something, you know?
that is the weirdest scene. I think that I'm just going to wrap this up by saying if I had a magic lamp and the genie was a very specific genie who had only one power and it was to allow me to improve any of the six movies that we've watched so far, and I can only improve one to be a great movie, I'd probably choose this one to bump it up. Because I think Khan and Voyage Home can stand as they are, okay? Mm-hmm. But I think that this one had the most potential that it's a good movie. It didn't really fully realize where it was. And I think that this one could be easily bumped up quite a bit. And I don't think that Final Frontier, Motion Picture, or Search for Spock really have that potential in them.
Yeah, I would say that. Well, the last one you said you thought 5 had the biggest potential that was unrealized.
Yeah.
Do you now think that 6 is that?
No, I think that 5's potential is too, like, ethereal. I don't think the show could ever really deal with what 5 is trying to talk about.
I see. Okay. Like, you're saying that 6 is like, if your genie was just like a good screenwriter genie.
Yes.
You could punch that thing up and you'd be good to go.
Yes. And I don't think I'd be satisfied with a improved version of 5. I would still feel like, whatever. Like, I don't know if I need this movie.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
That's it. Guys, thank you very much for listening. Clay, thanks for coming on.
No problem. I've really excuse me. I've really enjoyed this. As I've said probably multiple times at this point, the TOS crew movies was my Star Trek, you know, but I was into TNG, but I was into the movies more. So it's been really fun to go back and watch these. I haven't watched a lot of them in a long time, so it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I think they're worth a watch, even the bad ones, just to make your own decision about them, because there is so much like groupthink, to use a word that has been thrown at us.
I'm glad you've reminded me of this, but yeah, finish your thought.
You know, there's been so much of that groupthink mindset about, you know, which ones are good and which ones are bad. No, that the evens are good and the odd ones are bad. Even though we did rank them that way, but it's not that hard of a line draw. Like, the stuff that's bad about 3, it's not like it's a train wreck, you know? 3, you can fix. There's still enjoyable stuff in it. I know you'd liked it the least, but...
Yeah.
5 has some weird stuff in it that's kind of fun. It's not a really good movie, but, you know, it's still worth a watch. I've had a good time doing this.
I think it's funny, we hadn't actually talked about this, but you kind of pretty much summed up what I was going to say. If I'm harsh on any of these movies, I find them more similar to each other than dissimilar. The variation in how good and how bad they are is not a huge distance between them.
Yes, yeah.
They're
with the exception, I do still think that Wrath of Khan is considerably better.
Yes.
Than like the worst ones.
Yes.
But generally, I agree with you.
I guess my point would be I don't consider any of the movies to be hitting hugely great heights, even the best ones. And mm-hmm. I don't consider any of the worst ones to be terrible, terrible movies that are not worth watching.
Yeah, yeah.
They kind of exist in that sort of middle ground, and some of them are a higher middle ground than some of the other ones. But I don't think that they – this mostly comes from the Final Frontier feedback, which was a lot of listener feedback about Final Frontier was I got a lot of this movie is underrated comments, and I got a yep. lot of this movie is the worst movie ever made comments, and I disagree with both of those takes on it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So it's somewhere in that middle ground for me.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to talk about, to change gears a little bit, I did want to talk about one other thing before we go.
Mm-hmm.
This is officially the last, unless there's something I'm forgetting, this is the last time we're going to see Spock. Until, I don't know if you're planning on doing the JJ stuff.
Yeah, this
is the last appearance.
Yes. Because he's actually been in Unification before this, and TNG.
Right, but I mean, like, as far as we are going...
Oh, yeah, I see
what
you mean.
This is the last time we will see him.
Yeah, I think so, right? Yeah, it is. It must be. Yep.
And, you know, I was thinking about it because I feel like Nimoy, at least traditionally, has been depicted as sort of wanting to distance himself from Spock. You know, he had that book, his name of the biography is I Am Not Spock, and, you know, all these stories like, well, he only... He has to be killed off in the second one because he wanted more money and all this kind of, you know, all these kind of like kind of derogatory, slightly derogatory things about his approach to the character and where he stands and where the show stands with him.
Yeah.
But, you know, having watched all these movies, and I watched that documentary that his son made, and I was thinking about that documentary as I was watching these, and he might arguably care about it more than anybody else.
You know what I think the dividing line is? He started to really care about it when they gave him a little bit of creative control over the process.
Yeah, yeah, because that's where it started to really kind of come through for me. Where it's like, you know, he's ever since number three, he's been involved with the creative making of every one of these movies to some extent.
I would say even two. Allowing him the death scene feels like the first hint of, oh, they're actually going to listen to some of my ideas now, and I'd like to come back, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, you could argue that, you know, all of that stuff was just for money purposes or whatever, but I mean, he seems like once they gave him a reason other than just money to be invested in, it seemed like he was sort of like a caretaker of the series to a certain extent.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know Meyer someone was talking about that when on this one especially, he was an executive producer, and he was basically the guy who was the go-between for Meyer and the studio. And Nimoy, he was actually saying, he's like, you know, anything that he wanted, I would, you know, he would explain it to me and I would do the best that I could to make sure that happened. You know,
yeah.
It seemed like
yeah.
he did care about what was happening. You know, I don't know where Shatner stands on this stuff, but he seemed to be the most invested of all of these guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's interesting looking back to see, you know, to see that much interest from him, because it's not traditionally the way that people think about him, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I think that's very fair to say. And I think as we've ended the TOS thing, he's the Spock character is almost ironically the heart of the show and the movies in a lot of ways. And Nimoy, as the creative person, is probably one of the more important creative people who are involved in this because, you know, Roddenberry dropped off after the failure of the first movie. Mm-hmm. They brought in real movie types, but they needed Nimoy's sort of cachet, which was related to his importance to the series and his ability to sort of work with the executives in a lot of different ways, like you're saying, being sort of the peacekeeper between everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was very important. I think that he embraced it the more he went along. You know, before he died, he was still frequently tweeting about Star Trek and everything like that.
Right, right.
So I think he kind of just came to realize you know, I guess age kind of calms you. He gave up on his musical aspirations. He gave up on everything else, and he's just like, you know, it was a pretty good thing what I had going there for a while.
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah, that's it for the TOS movies, and you're right, we're done with Spock. The only people we're going to have back are Chekhov, Scotty, and Kirk at this point.
I can't wait for Generations. I'm really looking forward to seeing Guinan interact with Christian Slater.
I'm looking forward to getting back into the TNG crew for a little bit, a couple movies anyway. But I'm
wondering how it's going to feel.
Yes,
like once all of that good stuff shows up. If I'm going to get like a nostalgia bomb for like what was it last year?
Yes.
But you know, you spend so much time with those guys, and then you switch gears, and then you come back, and it's I don't know something refreshing about it.
You do, and we blew through TOS so quickly that we didn't really have a time to settle in with them. But I feel that the movies did a good job.
One other thing that I wanted to point out: is it weird to you, given they do it in the new the TNG movies, and they've of course done it with the new movies? They don't really change the uniforms movie to movie. Like at all, and it kind of surprised me because I know we talked about how you know the 2, 3, and 4 are kind of like a trilogy. Mm-hmm. Well, they literally a trilogy.
Yeah,
but they even after that they don't really make any changes to the uniform or the look of anything, and just which makes sense in the real world.
Yeah,
but as far as movies go, usually every time they do a new one of these, it's an excuse to tweak something,
change
the design. And I was kind of surprised by that.
If I had to guess, I would think it's all budget, and they just reusing the same stuff that they wore in the previous movies.
And then as soon as they were done with it, they put it back on the truck, and it drove two stops over so everyone could wear it for yesterday's Enterprise.
Which will be funny. It'll give us something to talk about Generations, because if you're into costuming, Generations is a disaster of a movie as far as costuming goes. But we'll be getting into that when we get into it. So, we're going to – for people who are not in the know, we're going to be doing the TNG movies next. So we've got Generations, First Contact, Insurrection, and then Nemesis. And that'll be it. I don't think we're going to do the Kelvin movies at this point. I'll probably give a little bit of space so that we can come back to them at some point.
Is that what they call the JJ movies?
Yeah, because it's the Kelvin universe. It's not the Prime universe.
Oh, I didn't know that was what they called it.
Yeah, so we'll probably come back to those at some point, giving us a little breather there. But yeah, we're going to be moving into TNG, getting to know all that stuff, going on to Generations. But that's it for the TOS movies, 1-6. If you guys are on YouTube and you like this stuff, a like and a comment's appreciated. If you're on iTunes or any of the podcatchers, you can rate us there. Facebook.com/ThePenske Podcast and then Patreon.com/ThePenske File. You go there a couple dollars a month, less than the price of a cup of coffee. You can support the show. You get extra content. We talk about things that aren't always Star Trek related, aren't sci-fi related, movie related, film related, TV, all that kind of stuff. And that's about it. And do we have any other news, Clay? Do you have any news? Anything that we should say before we sign off here?
Oh, geez. I don't think so. Yeah. The last issue of my comic I've been drawing, Redline, is coming out next month. I think it might be next week or the week after that. So keep your eyes open for that. So all 5 of them will be out there, and go buy them.
That's right. Yeah, the 4th one came out recently, so you guys can go check that out. It's Redline. Get them wherever comics are sold.
Very, very much not for children.
Yes.
Just going to put that out there.
And that's I think that's pretty much it. Yeah, otherwise we're just going to be marching forward as usual. You guys can email me at thepenskefilevideo@gmail.com if you want any kind of stuff. We've gotten some good letters from people recently. It's much appreciated, even if I don't mention them on the show. Just know that I do read them. I try to respond to everyone. I try to respond to all the comments and everything.
I really love the comments. I love hearing what people think about all this stuff.
Yeah, so we've got a pretty thoughtful audience going at this point, which is kind of surprising to me. Even on YouTube, people are the trolley people have kind of faded away, but everyone who's remained has been. I'm very happy with all the feedback we get. And the show is really at this point about the community, and that's what the Patreon is about too. So if you'd like to do that,
yeah, it's fun too because I feel like with something with specifically Star Trek, but with any sort of like fan heavy thing, there's the danger of, people who don't share the same opinion as you, or let's say your opinion is not favorable to things that they love.
Yeah.
It's easy for people to kind of like, tear into you about stupid shit or whatever. Luckily, there's been none of that. I mean, there's been a lot of great discussions about stuff, and it's been really, really, you know, high level, worth reading stuff, which is great.
Yeah. You know what might be a big piece of this is that I think the show and stuff might be old enough where people have grown out of that. I think the audience skews older here, which is interesting. But yeah, it's all great. It's good to talk to you guys. Thanks very much for writing. Thanks for following the show, listening, all that stuff. It sounds like this is like the final episode, which I guess ties into the what the hell did we just watch? The Undiscovered Country. But it's not the final episode of the podcast. We'll be back with Generations next week. I'm excited for it.
What you won't be able to hear is when we're done, we're both going to sign our names in the air.
Oh, yeah. I'm just going to hold on a minute. I'll just do the... All right, there we go. There's mine signed on. Cleo signed his.
All right, here
we go. That actually sounded like you were DJ Fury spitting out the hottest... the hottest tracks we've ever heard. But that's it. The Undiscovered Country. We're done. We're moving on to Generations. Thanks very much, guys. I'll see you next time.